We are into our second of a, I don't know how many sermons I'm going to preach on this, to be honest with you, so I can't tell you how many. But I've had this on my heart all summer, and last week we talked about the first, killing God. And we dealt with that time period between the Palm Sunday and Pentecost. And we talked about various things that took place that weekend, and then led into the eventuality of Pentecost, 50 days after Passover, thus the name Pentecost. And I wanted to begin this particular lesson as we're trying to draw application to what was in the hearts of those individuals in Acts chapter 2, verses 36 and 37, where they finally acknowledge, this is horrible what we have done, and then they cry out from that broken, cut heart, What can we do, brothers? What in the world? How can we solve this particular problem? And then Peter's going to launch into the summary. He's going to launch into the solution in verse 38, which we're not really going to deal with in this series. The point of this series is to talk about the point of ultimate conviction. What does that look like? How did it play out in the lives of those individuals? And then, of course, we need to draw forward an application for you and I, because that's what our assembly is about this morning. It's not just about what took place 2,000 plus years ago, but we need to know how that changes our lives today. As I tell my Mapsters every summer, as we're studying the Bible and we open up to a particular passage, my first question to those kids is, who cares? And I don't say that to be blasphemous, but I think it's important for us to recognize that unless the Bible changes us, unless you can answer that question, who cares? Who cares that it was ever written? Who cares that it was ever inspired? Who cares? Unless you can answer that question, it doesn't become yours. But if you answer that question, then you take ownership of that passage, and it ought to change you. It ought to make you a different person. And so, verses 36 and 37 of Acts chapter 2, who cares? There were a lot of folks all those years ago who came to a moment where it was ultimate conviction. We killed God. But who cares? That's them. Does it really matter to you? If it doesn't, then I would suggest to you that your heart is cold and you need to spend more time appreciating that which God has given to you. If it does resonate within you, then I would suggest to you that before this day is over, there needs to be changes made in your life. Just as I have been meditating and thinking and studying on the subject, I've made changes in mine this week. There needs to be changes that come, because the Bible was not just written so that you and I could read it every once in a while to put us asleep at night. It's written to change our lives. And so, the second installment. Last week, palms to Pentecost. This week, obviously odd. Obviously odd. There are some times in Scripture where God didn't just do the miraculous. He did the oddly miraculous. And we're going to talk about this morning. And I think especially the young people will appreciate some of the analogies and some of the things that we'll talk about in the lesson this morning. With that then, I want to take you on a quick journey of something that's amazing. At least I found it to be amazing this past week as I was studying it out. If you want to pedal back many, 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 many years to another transition. And it actually was a transition in law as well, interestingly enough. I thought about presenting an entire sermon on that subject. That in this moment of transition with Jesus, we're going now from the old law to the new law because all of it has been nailed to the cross. And so now we're entering into the new law. It's interesting, if you'll pedal back to when we got that first law at Sinai, you have some oddities that take place there as well. One in particular that we'll talk about this morning. The artist's rendering here in front of you is supposed to be that of the tabernacle. It was a tent-like structure. You remember, we talked at, this past summer as we gave the history and the general geography of the Old Testament. And we talked about that period when the tabernacle was presented by God. He gave them all the specifics that they needed to have with regards to the tabernacle. Then they messed up because their first attempt to enter into the promised land, they sent the 12 spies. Only two came back saying they could take the place. The other 10 won out. And God's displeased with their lack of faith because they've seen so much. And yet they don't have enough faith to go in and take over the promised land. And so God says, because of that, you're going to wander for 40 years. And so they wander in the desert for 40 years and everybody dies except for two individuals, Joshua and Caleb. They will actually go into the promised land. Moses himself is going to die before going into the promised land. But during that 40-year period, we've got the tabernacle. In fact, it goes into the promised land with them and exists for some time after they enter into the promised land. It's a tent-like structure, as I've already said, and that's intentional because God's people were constantly on the move. And as they're on the move, they had to pick up and they had to go. And so as they had this tent-like structure, they would stop every once in a while, wherever it happened to be, and the tent-like structure, the tabernacle, would be placed smack dab in the middle of the camp. Most of you are familiar with your Old Testament history. You know that there were two things that stayed with the tabernacle. During day, it would be a cloud. During night, there would be a pillar of fire. You can see the advantages probably for both of those. I don't know that the scriptures ever present this, but it seems likely that the cloud might very well present a shadow that they could dwell under and be able to have a coolness as they wander around the desert. Perhaps that was part of the idea, God giving himself or a manifestation as in a cloud. At night, the pillar of fire is going to do what? Obviously provide light. Maybe that was the whole idea. I don't know, but I do know that that's what the scriptures teach took place during that time of wandering. God was constantly present and obviously, there's our word again, obviously present throughout their period of wandering. I'm with you, God says. Don't miss this. But it wasn't enough for God's people. It just simply wasn't enough. There are several times that they went to complaining. We'll not deal with all of them. But the one time that is quite dramatic that we'll deal with this morning takes us to the Ark of the Covenant. For those young people who would like to have a reference here to Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, no, this is actually the Ark, Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's Indiana Jones there on the right. And that Ark of the Covenant was held within the most holy place. You're familiar with that as well. Two chambers within the tabernacle proper. And the first was the holy place. In there you got three pieces of furniture. You've got the candlesticks, you got the table of showbread, and you got the altar of incense. Remember, once a year, the high priest could go into the inner chamber, which was the Holy of Holies, and in there there's just one piece of furniture. And that one piece of furniture is what you're looking at. Let me give you a better picture. Maybe. That one piece of furniture is called the Ark of the Covenant. The top of the Ark of the Covenant was the mercy seat. Inside the Ark of the Covenant, this box-like structure that they carried around with them, there were three items. These items were placed there for memory's sake. Don't ever forget was the idea. And it's those three items that really bring us to the oddity of our moment here as we see this transition into a period of law. And then pedal forward, God willing, many, many years to the time of Jesus, and we see the transition from one law to another law. Inside the Ark of the Covenant, as you can see, there are three items. The Ten Commandments was probably the most obvious, the one that most of you probably were aware of. And this, of course, is the second one because, remember, Moses broke the first one. He got pretty mad. First one was written by who? God. Second one, seems like Moses had to chisel it out himself. But we got the Ten Commandments, and the Ten Commandments are contained within the Ark of the Covenant. And then there is the manna. The manna is an interesting one, although it's not the topic of our sermon this morning. It's the rod that budded that we want to get to. But I need to make sure I cover all three of them. The second one was the pot of manna. There was a point at which, even though God is there present with them, they can see the cloud and they can see the fire in the middle of the camp all the time. It's even though they're seeing that, they doubted him. God has done crazy cool miracles with regards to the Red Sea and humbling Egypt. All those things are in their past. They've seen all of that, but they get hungry. Is there anything like hunger to make a person lose their focus? Well, they get hungry at one point and they begin to complain. You know, back in Egypt, we had all kinds of wonderful things that we could eat. And they list various things like cucumbers and we don't have anything out here. And God says, I'm going to give you meat in the evening, and you'll have something like bread that will be on the ground during the morning hours. It's the manna that's in the pot that evidently never spoils. It stays within the Ark of the Covenant. But according to my research, and in fact, it's just what is said in Exodus chapter 16 and verse 31, this manna was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. That's the description that God gives in the text itself. That's what manna was like. But we're told that they could go out and they could pick it up every morning, but they were only to take what they needed. The rest of it would actually spoil if they took more than they needed. On the sixth day, what day would that be? Friday. Because remember, first day of the week is not Monday, according to our calendars. It doesn't matter what our secular calendars do. The first day of the week is Sunday, right? So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So on the sixth day, they're going to gather twice as much as they need. Why? Because the seventh day is the Sabbath. That's why I happen to believe that the 7 days of creation are actually literal days. Because if you don't do literal days in the first seven, it seems like it messes up the Sabbath day idea on the seventh day. The seventh day is the Sabbath day. They're not to do any work on that particular day. So they pick up their manna the day before. God also says that because of their whimpering and crying and they all wanting meat, God says, I'm going to send quail into the camp. And it sounds like it actually describes how far off the ground the quail actually fly through the camp. It sounds like they're able to walk out the front door of their tent, grab them a quail or two, take it in, fry it up for supper or whatever they need. God just basically is putting in front of them everything that they want, but they're still not happy. And their lack of happiness boils over into a story that we find in Numbers chapter 16 and 17. And that's where I want you to go this morning in the few minutes that I have left. In Numbers chapter 16 and 17, a guy by the name of Korah is going to come on the scene. And Korah was very much like individuals that we see today. In fact, I've had some Korah moments in my own life. Korah was second-guessing Moses and his authority. In fact, he comes to a point and he says, Moses, I just think you're taking too much responsibility on yourself. He says, aren't we all the holy ones of God? And yet you seem to set yourself up in this place where you're able to lead us and make decisions. And we feel like that you've gone too far. And this, of course, frustrates Moses. But in his, evidently, at this point, level of self-control, sometimes he didn't have it. But at this particular point, he says, I'll tell you what, let's let God answer the question. And God answers the question in a rather dramatic way. There's our word, again, or the idea of our word, obviously odd. And you see that play out in this text. In Numbers chapter 16, beginning at verse 28, I'm just going to read much of the story for you straight out of the Bible. It says, then Moses said, this is how you will know, speaking to Korah and his folks, this is how you will know that the Lord has sent me to do all these things and that it was not my idea. I didn't come up with this idea of leading you guys through the wilderness. This is something that came from God. And I'll show you how we're going to know this. Verse 29. If these men die a natural death and experience only what usually happens to men, then the Lord has not sent me. He's not actually speaking to Korah. I should have said that. He's actually speaking to the entire assembly. And he's got Korah and his folks isolated at this point. He said, now look, God's going to move in one way or the other. And if these guys just die of old age, then I obviously am a liar. But if they die in some miraculous, may I say, odd way, then you'll know I'm the leader that God has chosen and you best get in line behind me. Verse 30. But if the Lord brings about something totally new, may I say odd, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them with everything that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the grave, then you will know that these men have treated the Lord with contempt. Well, you know the end of the story, but verse 31. As soon as he finished saying all this, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them, with their households and all of Korah's men, down alive into the grave with everything they owned. The earth closed over them, and they perished and were gone from the community. At their cries, all the Israelites around them fled, shouting, the earth is going to swallow us too. Odd? I think so. Dramatic? Obviously. But God's making a point. And I know that sometimes maybe we're over the top hard on the children of Israel because they should have known better. And I think really we're accurate in doing that. You and I certainly have an application for that. But think again what they have seen. It's not like God has said to them, you know, in some kind of cryptic form, I might sort of take care of you as you're wandering around in the wilderness. It's not like he didn't show himself on Mount Sinai where he got all kinds of lightning bolts and stuff just showing itself at the top of the mountain. It's not like he didn't part the Red Sea so they could walk across on dry land. It's not like he didn't do 10 plagues on the folks there in Egypt to humble them and bring them to their knees. God has showed himself repeatedly. And then Korah says, but I'm not sure, Moses, you're really God's man. And Moses says, okay, you really want to go there? Let's let God show. Let's let God decide. and the earth literally splits open and swallows Korah and everybody who had decided to be rebellious against Moses. And their stuff goes down into the earth, and then it says the earth closes up again on top of them. But here's where it gets painfully obvious with regards to their lack of appreciation for God. I want you to skip just a few verses, verse 41. The first three words are just striking to me. The next day. Okay, yesterday we saw the earth open up and Korah and all his folks go down into the earth, okay? This is the next day. The next day, the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. You have killed the Lord's people, they said. But when the assembly gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron and turned toward the tent of meeting, suddenly the cloud covered it and the glory of the Lord appeared. Then Moses and Aaron went to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord said to Moses, get away from this assembly so I can put an end to them at once. And they fell down, face down. Then Moses and Aaron said, Then Moses said to Aaron, take your censer and put incense in it, along with the fire from the altar, and hurry to the assembly to make atonement for them. And if you go on to read, it says that Aaron actually runs through the assembly, and there's this great plague that's taking place, and as he runs through the assembly, it stays the plague. Yet 14,700 people die because they didn't get the message of yesterday. Now, it's hard for me to see that, and maybe it's hard for you to see that as well, and wonder how in the world could people not get the message? Yesterday, Korah and all his folks buried alive. Today, we're going to gripe again? I'd just be scared to death to even approach Moses. And yet they challenge Moses and his authority. This is where we get to the rod that buds. It says that you continue reading, starting in chapter 17, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and get 12 staves from them, one from the leader of each of their ancestral tribes. So we got each tribe has a staff, has a rod. Write the name of each man on his staff. On the staff of Levi, write Aaron's name, for there must be one staff for the head of each ancestral tribe. Place them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony where I meet with you. The staff belonging to the man I choose will sprout, and I will rid myself of this constant grumbling against you by the Israelites. And so he says, everybody get a stick, and they're going to put it in the tent, and the one stick that sprouts, you're going to know whoever's name's on that one, that's the guy who I am going to work through with regards to this group of people. Verse 6, so Moses spoke to the Israelites and their leaders, gave them 12 sticks, staffs, one of the leaders for each ancestral tribe, etc. Moses placed the staffs before the Lord in the tent of testimony. Verse 8, the next day Moses entered the tent of testimony, watch it, and saw Aaron's staff, the staff which represented the house of Levi. The staff had not only sprouted, but had budded. It not only sprouted and budded, it had blossomed. It not only sprouted and budded and blossomed, it actually was producing almonds. Then Moses brought out all the staves from the Lord's presence to all the Israelites. They looked at them, and each man took his own staff. The Lord said to Moses, put back Aaron's staff in front of the testimony to be kept as a sign to the rebellious. This will put an end to their grumbling against me so that they will not die. Moses did just as the Lord commanded. We talk a lot about the Ten Commandments in the Ark of the Covenant, a little bit more about the manna, but there's very, very little actually talked about Aaron's rod, and the reason is because you just don't have a lot. This is really the only place we got much of a story with regards to Aaron's rod. But in this you find again the dramatics of God, the oddities of making sure he puts his stamp of approval on something. This is my will. This is the way it needs to be done. I'm almost done, but I want to make two thoughts. I hasten to remind you that God, after all the rebellion of the people, God has said, step away, Moses and Aaron. I'm just going to wipe them out. By the way, it's not the first or last time he'll say that. God repeatedly gets so fed up with these folks who are so full of themselves and can't, they just don't have a moment of thanksgiving. It's like they can't see anything around them that God is providing for them. He's literally handing them their food of a night and of a morning, and they don't have any happiness because of it. And I can't help but see some of the American culture in that very thing as well. And yet I remind you that it's Moses who goes to God repeatedly, and he says, God, please, 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 don't. And for the sake of Moses and Aaron, he doesn't. And then we have the great oddity of the staves, the sticks, basically. 12 of them. But Aaron's, it doesn't just bud. It produces almonds. God always goes over and above, does he not? You remember the feeding of the thousands and the little sack lunch and all of that? You remember those stories? And what did they do at the end of those stories? They pick up the leftovers. God doesn't just provide enough. He always provides more than enough. God always gives us over an abundance so that we can recognize. At the end of the day, please recognize, God says. I'll even go to the odd, if I have to make the point, I love you. And so I end. I know that I've done a lot from this pulpit with regards to Islam, and probably many of you get tired of it. We've done the seminar and various things, but I want to draw a parallel again. On the left-hand side, you see a text from the Quran, 19th Surah, verse 88. These are the supposed words of Muhammad that he supposedly got from his God, Allah. Those who say the Lord of mercy has begotten a son, well, they preach a monstrous falsehood, at which the very heavens might crack, the earth split asunder, and the mountains crumble to dust. Those who believe that God actually has a son, they preach such a monstrous falsehood, monstrous false doctrine, that the earth itself just wants to quake because of the horrible concept that God would actually have a son. I think not, says Muhammad. On the right-hand side of your screen, you have two texts, these from the Holy Word of God himself. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice, and he yielded up his spirit, Matthew 27. Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks did split, and the graves were opened. You see the contrast between these two? On the one hand, you have a God, Allah, who couldn't possibly love you that much, that he would actually have a son, and then the blasphemous thought that his son would actually come and die at the hands of those he has created. I think not, says Muhammad. And then God says, oh, but I do. For God so loved the world. You see the contrast between the two. Let me draw one more by way of inviting you to the front if you need to. The world in general will make the same contrast. You got sin in your life. God can't love you. You are a major mess up. You are such a disappointment. Think of all the promise that you had when you were 7 years old. Now look back over the years and look what you've done with your life. You are a failure. You need to wallow in the grief and the guilt. God can't love somebody like you. That's what the world will say. But God will say, as Dustin actually mentioned in his prayer this morning, in spite of your sin, I still want you. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, Paul will say in the book of Romans. That's love. On the left hand of your side of your screen, you do not see love. But on the right hand side of your screen, you see a love that I might say with all the reverence that I can muster, a love that's odd. It's obviously odd. Nobody loves us like that in the world. Nobody. But God says, I do. God says, I will. God says, I don't care where you've been. I'll take you back. I want you back. I'll send my son to die for you so that you can come back. Call me odd. Call me obviously odd. But I love you. And it's for that reason that on the day of Pentecost, in Acts chapter 2, verses 36 and 37, people began to examine themselves, look back over their history, maybe even to this crazy story of Korah, and say to themselves, really? They were so selfish, so narrow-minded, and we did the same thing. We're just like them. God sends us a messenger. He sends us a savior. Just like Moses was a savior to them. And what do? We gripe and we complain. And we refuse to give him the authority that he deserves. We kill God. And they changed. At least 3,000 of them. The question is, will we? Will we? I love you. You know you're my people. But we are some of the most selfish people on the planet. We are. We are so full of ourselves. We live for our conveniences. We daily almost take part in recreational shopping and recreational eating. It's not because we need the stuff. It's we just want it. And it's hard for folks like us to look up and to recognize God is being obviously odd in his love towards us. Will we this morning choose to be obviously odd in our reaction toward all the materialism and worldly stuff that the folks around us say is what really marks success? Will we? What changes do you need to make in your life? How do you need to readjust your priority list? As we sing this song, there may be individuals who publicly need the prayers of the church. There may be individuals who are not even on God's team. They have not loved Jesus enough to be buried with him in baptism, to rise and walk in the newness of life. There may be some of us who just need to stand there and in our silence, because we're too broken to even sing the song, say, God, forgive me. As we sing this song, if you have something on your heart that we as a church can help you with, we sing it for your encouragement. Please come forward if you need to as we stand and as we sing.